It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. An anonymous caller has terrorized communities around the country, including here in Wisconsin, by reporting false shooting threats at over 180 schools, according to NPR's investigations. We explore what is going on with these hoaxes and the impact on local police departments and schools. Bring your thoughts on hoaxes and swatting, where law enforcement descends on a location where a crime is reportedly in progress. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Odette Youssef is domestic extremism correspondent for NPR and has been investigating hoax active shooter calling sprees. Odette, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's discuss swatting first, these prank calls in which someone, you know, makes a false report and then in order to get a SWAT team dispatched to like a school. Why is swatting dangerous?
Well, swatting, as you mentioned, is a report where someone is about to or in the middle of committing a crime somewhere, and what it's intended to do is prompt just an immense law enforcement response, so that police and SWAT teams, hence the name swatting, are deployed to that location. They're often entering the location with their guns, with their guns out. They may be breaking down doors to get into the location, and it can be extremely dangerous because if the target of the swatting scheme is unsuspecting, they may think that somebody's coming, you know, breaking into their home. And this has actually resulted, Kate, in fatalities. In 2017, there was quite a well-known one where a man in Wichita was killed as a result of a swatting hoax. This really kind of started with extremely online communities. You know, it became sort of known as a prank within the live gaming community, where they would actually, people would be swatted in real time while the people, you know, who had called in the hoax were watching it happen on their computers in real time. It became also part of the toolkit and playbook for extremist groups to try to target some of their perceived enemies. But this seems to be something kind of new, what we're seeing now with these school swattings, because what we're learning about it suggests that these calls may be coming from overseas, and just the scale and the scope of them.
Yes, the scale and the scope. What have you learned about this wave of swatting across America that's targeting schools?
Well, we first started hearing about this in like mid-September. So, what we've been doing is just gathering local reports about these incidents at schools all over the country. The first one that we've been able to find was September 13th. And in the six or so weeks since then, we have counted close to 200 instances of schools being swatted that we believe fit one particular pattern that we believe could be connected to this one caller. I will say that I do believe that we have significantly undercounted the number, just because not every local report has been sharing all the details of the schools that have been receiving these calls.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment. Odette Youssef with us as we discuss the series of hoax school shooting reports across the country, what that means. Odette is a domestic extremism correspondent for NPR who's been tracking this data. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So, Odette, NPR obtained recordings that suggest a connection between this recent wave of false school shooting threats and several false bomb threats made in March and April. And let's listen to a part of a false bomb threat placed in April.
Hello. Suspicious backpack has been left in the high school. Hello. Binton High School, number 205. Hello. Suspicious backpack has been left in the high school.
So what do you know from analyzing the calls themselves?
Yeah, so that particular call was made to the Bossier Parish Sheriff's Office in Louisiana back in late April. And the reason that we sort of started looking into these hoax bomb alerts was that when we were looking at the active shooter calls, some authorities in Minnesota had told us that the calls they had received about active shooters sounded really similar to calls that they had received earlier back in the spring about these bombs. And so we went back, we looked for news articles about hoax bomb threats in the spring, and Bossier Parish was one of the places where this happened at Benton High School. And so what we found when we, you know, we've been submitting a lot of open records requests to learn more about these calls, and it turned out that the Bossier Parish Sheriff's Office did quite a thorough investigation into the source of this call, including tracing back the phone number that was used to make the call, things like the IP addresses that were associated with that internet phone number, and even the Gmail account that had been created to be able to make that internet phone number account. So we were able to look more closely at what happened in the spring with this one particular phone number that had made this hoax call, not only to this one place in Louisiana, but as it turned out, had called roughly 162 unique places over a 40-day period. And we were able to really examine sort of the mode of operation of this caller.
And this was rapid dialing. I mean, from one call to the next, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting because even though this person, even though these records showed a 40-day period of this phone number, the person really was only active for 10 of those days. And actually, you know, more than three quarters of their activity with this phone number was on 3 days. And when we analyzed the, you know, activity on those 3 days, this person was treating this like their full-time job. They would log on to their internet phone number account at a certain hour that would be Monday. It would be morning time for the place that they were targeting. And they would just keep systematically dialing and redialing numbers, sometimes with as few as 4 seconds in between. Sometimes, you know, there were longer breaks, 20 minutes. At one point, there was at least an hour break. So, you know, but this would be their day until they were done 6 to 8 hours later.
State and local law enforcement have said that they're working with the FBI to trace the source of the calls. What have you learned about the investigations at both the state and federal level? What is going on?
You know, the FBI has been pretty tight-lipped about this. You know, what they've said is that they are aware of these incidents and they are working with state and local officials. And in some states, it does look like there has been much more coordination in terms of gathering the information pertaining to these calls. I've already referenced Minnesota. They seem to have been gathering information and disseminating alerts to the schools at a much earlier stage than some other states have. But we haven't learned so far terribly much about where higher authorities are with their investigation.
Odette Youssef, national security correspondent for NPR, focused on extremism, explaining dangerous hoax calls across the U.S. targeting schools and what she's learned through her reporting on this. Join in our conversation about hoax calls, about copycat calls, what can be done by law enforcement. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into a hoax calling spree, recent lockdowns at schools reacting to false active shooter threats, and what schools and law enforcement should do about it. NPR found local reports around the country that 182 schools in over two dozen states, including Wisconsin, received these hoax calls about threats between mid-September and last week. Join our conversation about scare campaigns, about public safety, swatting cases, and whether these can be viewed as acts of terrorism. 800-642-1234. Odette Youssef is a domestic extremism correspondent for NPR and stays with us. Odette, let's talk about tracing these calls and what the connection could be to Ethiopia and the technology to make these calls.
Yeah, so, you know, some of the news reports that we were gathering when we started investigating this were quoting local officials who said that federal authorities had told them that these calls might be connected to overseas, they might be connected to Africa, and then there were a couple that said specifically that they might be connected to Ethiopia. And when we ended up obtaining those records from that one parish in Louisiana about the false bomb alert they received back in April, we were able to look at the IP addresses that were associated with those calls. And indeed, they do trace back to an IP address that is managed by something called the AFRINIC network in Africa, and specifically managed by Ethio Telecom, which is basically the state-owned telecom company in Ethiopia. You know, I will note that that does not conclusively mean that these calls were in fact originating in Ethiopia. There are various ways that people can sort of disguise where they're really located. You know, we explored this question of whether they were using a VPN service, for example, to redirect, you know, to Ethiopia for their traffic. We think that that's actually quite unlikely, given the rules that the text or the internet phone number company has around signing up for accounts. But it is still possible that somebody was using sort of a compromised IP address mm-hmm. that is based in Ethiopia to do these calls. You know, one thing that has really helped us try to identify which calls fit into this pattern is simply the voice and accent of the person making the calls. You know, as you heard in the tape that we listened to in the previous segment, you know, this is somebody who does have a heavy accent, sounds to be perhaps a North African accent. And so we do think that it is quite possible that this person is, in fact, located in Ethiopia.
What about the platform TextNow that allows users to place anonymous calls with U.S. numbers? How could that type of platform be linked to what is going on here?
So that is the platform that this caller has been using to make these calls. You know, this is what was found in the investigative records that we have looked at. We've also found that for this more recent spree of false active shooter calls, I think I've gotten so far about 7 unique phone numbers that have been used to make some of these calls recently, and all of those have been TextNow phone numbers. You know, this is voice over internet protocol. So these are internet phone numbers. You can just sign up with them online. I signed up for one. It took, you know, less than 3 minutes to do. And what it does is it gives you a US-based phone number. And these are numbers that require, you know, very little verification to sign up for them. They're so easy to create, and they're also really easy to ditch and make a new one if it gets, you know, reported.
Mm. We're talking about this wave of false reports putting schools across the country on lockdown. Odette Youssef is a domestic extremism correspondent with NPR, and you can join in the conversation about swatting these hoaxes. 800-642-1234. Odette, Wisconsin lawmakers like State Senator Rob Coles of Green Bay has called for the perpetrator or perpetrators of these calls to be charged under Wisconsin law. What sort of criminal charges could people making these calls face?
So this is a really interesting question because swatting is a crime in many states, and it is typically the kind of crime that has really only had to be handled at the state level. What is making this so unusual is that if, in fact, it is the case that this is an overseas caller, we don't actually have any federal anti-swatting legislation in this country. And so this is, you know, prompting some questions about whether it's time to finally pursue that kind of legislation. There has been legislation to that effect introduced in the past, but it hasn't come to fruition. And so, you know, I think that that is a real question that some of our federal lawmakers are going to have to look at. I think also it's, you know, something that our federal law enforcement agencies have to consider when it comes to what authorities they have when, you know, investigating this, because this does not fall under sort of our classic definition of terrorism.
And Bozier, when you talked with Bozier, they said, look, this is terrorism, but is that different from an act of terrorism in order to investigate this as a real crime?
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about foreign terrorism, you know, typically you have to find, the case has to either be one that's affiliated with an organization like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, for example, or there has to be a clear political motivation or a geopolitical motivation behind it. And that is what has been such a mystery here, Kate. We cannot figure out what motive an overseas actor may have for calling active shooter threats at schools. We know that it prompts sort of the psychological toll. We know that among kids and teachers and parents that are in those communities, we know that it is siphoning off law enforcement resources to a hoax. But that still doesn't check off one of the sort of important boxes that you need for something to qualify as an act of foreign terrorism. And we're not going to be able to call it really an act of terrorism in sort of the technical sense until we discern why this person is doing this.
Mike from Slinger called in, couldn't stay on the line, but Mike wonders if there is anything common about the schools targeted, that if you saw any patterns, are they suburban or urban? You know, do they have anything in common?
No. There are public schools, there are private schools, there are schools that we found in major metropolitan cities, there are schools that we found in very small places in the United States. What's really been just so remarkable to me in looking at the call records of those false bomb alerts back in the spring is that this person had a pretty much a working list of locations to call. You know, upwards of 90% of the places they called were schools directly or law enforcement agencies, fire departments or dispatch agencies. So they somehow have been able to obtain pretty much working lists of institutions that have crossed both public and private.
This puts schools in a really tough spot. How are schools responding to these fake active shooter threats?
Well, you know, in many of the open records reports that I have received responses to, the schools are going into lockdown. They are notifying their dispatch agencies, and police are being deployed in large numbers to the schools. In some cases, some states have sort of figured out that, you know, there are, like, their state is being targeted on a particular day, and so they sort of put out the announcement so that, you know, people, the law enforcement agents respond, but they are also aware that it could very well be a hoax. You know, the tricky thing here, Kate, is that in the wake of, you know, horrible tragedies like the shooting at Uvalde, nobody wants to be caught flat-footed. You know, the moment that a reported active shooter is said to be at a school, nobody wants to be in the situation where they don't respond adequately, and then it turns out to have actually been the case. And so, you know, schools are trying to balance that, and local law enforcement agencies are trying to balance that against, you know, the fact that this can create a lot of trauma for the kids that are being suddenly placed into lockdown, panic for the parents, and just sort of the siphoning off of public resources to deal with, you know, a prank.
Odette, thank you for joining us and for sharing your reporting on this.
Thanks for having me.
Odette Youssef is a domestic extremism correspondent for NPR. And we have a link, by the way, to her reporting on swatting and these hoax calls. Go to WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Transportation Department has this bulleted list of driving tips, like don't drive when you are angry, upset, or overly tired. Here's another one. Driving should not be a race unless you are driving a race car on a privately owned track. And here's one in bold. Treat others the way you would like to be treated. A little golden rule there, huh? Bring your driving advice, 800-642-1234. Aaron Chapin is McFarland Chief of Police and a police instructor at Madison College. Chief Chapin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
You've worked in law enforcement for more than two decades. You train police officers. Is driving becoming safer or more treacherous out there from your perspective?
I think we've seen a couple of trends recently that there has been an increase in dangerous driving behavior, particularly throughout 2020 when there were less people on the roads. There was less law enforcement action because agencies were concerned about officers contracting COVID and not quite sure how to address those issues. So there was less enforcement. And then I think that turned into some more dangerous driving behavior, which is carried into what we're seeing today.
You mean that people thought they could get away with going way over the speed limit? I mean, look, we're seeing tickets excess 100 miles an hour with speeding tickets way up in that category. What's going on?
I think there's a couple of things to that. I don't know that the COVID time period and the dangerous driving behavior that we saw during 2020 leads to that excessive driving behavior, but there have been things going on that we've seen where there is that excessive type of behavior. The city of Madison, Dane County Sheriff's Office, their traffic teams are out there and are seeing those cases where they're stopping people for doing 30 or 40 miles an hour over the speed limit. So I do think that there is a piece of it that people think that, or some people think that there's not a likelihood that they are going to get stopped, which could drive that behavior.
Electric cars are becoming incredibly fast, capable of going from 0 to 60 in a few seconds. Are speedier vehicles causing safety issues?
I think the thing to keep in mind is that people's behavior is the ultimate reason for that. Whether the machine is capable of doing it or not isn't driving the decision of the driver to do that. But there could be people that are choosing to do more risky behavior and engaging in that type of dangerous driving behavior.
But
I don't think it's electric cars completely or muscle cars or, you know, the type of vehicles that are out there, because there's a lot of vehicles out there that are capable of driving well over 100 miles per hour. But many drivers are choosing not to engage in that risky behavior.
A little follow-up there, though, as we talk about that, because Teslas, they come, you know, with these advanced hardware capabilities of providing autopilot and self-driving software capabilities. Are officers worried about those features, seeing, you know, as we see more and more Teslas on the road?
I think there could be a little bit of cause for concern, because you're taking the human element out of decision-making. And technology is not perfect. So That is a concern from my perspective. When I was a patrol officer, I did a lot of traffic. I'm a radar instructor, so I teach police officers how to utilize radar to stop speeders. And we know that increased speed is a significant factor in increasing the fatality risk if there is a crash that's caused. So if we're taking the human element out of vehicles and driving vehicles, that can create or could create a cause for concern. I think as technology continues to increase, that technology could get better, but the reality is that it's still technology and it can fail.
Let's bring on a caller now. Eric is with us in Stratford. Eric, hi. Eric, can you hear us?
Yes, hello.
Hi, yes. What are you encountering?
Well, I'm just wondering why motorists are allowed to drive with animals on their lap, their heads hanging out the window. I mean, isn't that a form of distracted driving also?
Okay, I want to repeat that for you, Chief Chapin. People driving with their pets on their lap, animals with heads out the window, isn't that a form of distracted driving?
I think ultimately for distracted driving, for us to be able to enforce it from a law enforcement perspective, we have to be able to show that there are decisions or things that the driver is doing that does divide the attention. There are boatloads of things out there that drivers do that are dangerous. I've seen in my personal vehicle when I've been driving around, people who are putting on makeup or eating breakfast, you know, bowl of cereal as they're driving down the road, which clearly in a situation where you've got what's called divided attention, driving requires divided attention. We're doing multiple things. We're watching traffic around us. We're having to check blind spots. We're looking at mirrors. We're using our turn signal, pushing on the accelerator, steering. All of those things, there's divided attention tasks that are occurring. And if we're adding something else into the mix that's allowing us or prohibiting us from being able to make good decisions and to be able to control that vehicle safely, it could be considered distracted driving. But from an enforcement standpoint, we need to be able to show that the behavior that the driver is engaged in is truly distracted for us to be able to write a citation.
And on that laundry list of distractions in the vehicle, I would imagine smartphones are near the top of the list.
Absolutely. Yeah, the more technology that we've got in our hands, the greater the increase for potential issues related to distracted driving.
We're talking about driver safety with McFarland Police Chief Aaron Chapin. You can join in on what you've seen. Tips and advice, 800-642-1234, and keeping safe behind the wheel. Let's go to Tom now in Kenosha. Tom, hi.
Hello.
Hi, we can hear you.
Okay. I just had a couple points. One was, you know, to what extent do, like, car manufacturers bear responsibility for some of the excessive speeds? You know, I've seen more supercars on the road than ever in history, you know, primarily Chrysler products, although I understand Chrysler's not going to be building the Chargers and Challengers much longer. And secondly, is it because there's a paucity of driver education that may, you know, explain some of the lack of, you know, knowledgeable behavior about, you know, the rules of the road and proper etiquette?
Chief Chapin, go ahead on those two questions.
So I think vehicle manufacturers, they do things to try to be in compliance with NHTSA, which is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, national DOT and state DOT regulations, to try to make things as safe as possible because they do have a vested interest in it, but they also have to look at their market as well. So there are competing interests there. The vehicles that are out there today have got, for instance, Teslas, other EVs, and actually not even just EVs, but you see big display screens and things like that in vehicles. The vehicle manufacturers typically will disable a bunch of the functionality of that unless the vehicle is at a stop, so that we are trying to limit the amount of distracted driving that drivers are doing. But you have to think through things like your climate controls are incorporated into that, the radio, stuff like that. So there still are things that drivers are touching and utilizing during the their trips to be able to control climate, radio, and things like that in their vehicles. So, so I think that vehicle manufacturers, as much as they can, are trying to balance that.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, driver behavior is up to the person who's behind the wheel, and we need to look at that as the major factor, not necessarily the machine and blaming the machine.
Is there
the second question?
Yes. Is there anything that can be done in driver education? What needs to change there?
So, I'm not sure that at the 15 or 16 year old driver education level, and I've actually got a daughter who's just going through driver's ed right now, the fourth of my children to go through. There is a lot of talk about distracted driving, about intoxicated driving, things like that, those dangerous behaviors, things that we know increase risk. So I think driver education is trying to address that. But as we add additional instruction into driver's education, there's new technology that comes out or different statistical points and things like that. So it's a matter of trying to stay ahead of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not
mm-hmm.
quite sure what the perfect solution to that would be.
Rodney in Madison called, couldn't stay on the line. And Rodney was riding their bike, was hit by a car, had to go to the hospital, and noticed in the police report that the driver was not ticketed, and wants to know, is that common? What are the consequences when a driver hits a biker?
Sure. It depends on the every case is different. So the officers have to look at the case, the totality of the case, and figure out what the cause is. And in some circumstances, if it's an accident that was completely out of control of either individual, which sometimes that occurs, officers typically won't issue a citation because was there a behavior that the driver did, or did the driver just not see something, and the officer could tell that the driver or the cyclist or whoever was involved in the crash is being truthful about the circumstances. Officers have discretion to choose not to issue citations. So it really depends on the particular facts of the case. And I can't speak for that particular circumstance, but I've investigated crashes in the past where I've chosen not to issue citations because of the facts that if there really is a significant contributing factor where the driver was, for instance, on their cell phone and texting, I'd write that ticket every day because that cause for that accident absolutely, you know, can be contributed back to that. Or if it was a drunk driver, that arrest, I'm going to make that arrest every day, and I would expect that out of my team members.
We're getting safe driving tips from McFarland Police Chief Aaron Chapin with us with more than two decades of experience on the force. Join in on how you deal with scary situations on the road, what you've encountered, how you've reacted as a driver or passenger in those situations. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we get driving tips from a police chief, here are a couple more from the State Transportation Department. Relax. Take a deep breath. Getting stressed and upset will probably not get you there any faster, it says, and it might shorten your life. And go ahead and be late. It won't kill you to be 10 minutes late for an appointment. McFarland Police Chief Aaron Chapin stays with us for more tips. Chief Chapin, how can drivers stay alert and focused when there are so many distractions on the road?
That's a great question. I think one of the biggest things is to do what we can to make sure that we're limiting distractions within our vehicle. my wife and I have made intentional efforts to talk to our kids about distracted driving, and particularly in the area of cell phones. So we had a rule for our kids that if they were going to be driving, that the cell phone went in the back seat of the car so they're not tempted or they're not playing around with the cell phone instead of driving. That they would text us and say, hey, I'm leaving right here. The cell phone goes in like the pocket of the back seat or on the back seat of the car. They drive wherever they're going to go. Once they got there, they would text us, say, hey, I made it safely, and then move on. So limiting those distractions, inside your vehicle makes it much easier to pay attention to what's going on outside the vehicle and to be able to operate the vehicle in a safe and efficient manner.
I would tack on to that being a role model as the adult driver and modeling that for your kids who see how you use your phone.
Absolutely. Yeah, because do what I say and not what I do is not the way to end up showing leadership and to instill good behaviors into other individuals. We model what we see. We do the things that we see as opposed to what we hear typically.
Let's bring in Elizabeth in Milwaukee. Elizabeth, you've been driving out west. What did you encounter?
Speed limits can be 70 or 80. So if it's 80, people are driving 90, 95. If it's 70, they're driving 80, 85. So I politely go to the right, put my right turn signal on. I wave to people because I don't want to get other people agitated. I don't want to feel agitated, and I don't want to spend time with car insurance accidents. So they all zoom by. But the question on the table is, the speed limit is 70. The speed limit is 80. If you knock it down, people are going to go 10 to 15 over anyway. So why keep increasing it? Because people are just speeding 10 to 15 over. And I witnessed that within the 5,000 miles I drove. And it was concerning. And then one time, and I'm just going to make a joke, everybody goes, you know, 35, 40, and then everybody stops at the stop sign. And I asked a gentleman, I said, sir, could you let me know, are we all here to stop so that we can all go and discuss what brake shop we're going to go to get our brakes fixed? It's like, what is the point of speeding up to a red light and then stopping? You know, it doesn't make sense to me. So it's
Elizabeth, thank you for bringing your experiences. Chief McFarland, what about those speed limits as they increase?
That's a great point, because I think we see that particularly in Madison on the Beltline. You've got interstates that are around us. The interstates are at 70. People will come off the interstate onto the Beltline and still drive like at 70, but the speed limit there is 55. I think there's a handful of things that can help. I do think that enforcement is something, education and enforcement together, but enforcement is a piece of it. If people don't think that they're going to get cited, you know, and the risk of driving 7 to 10 over or 10 to 15, 15 to 20 over, if I've never been cited or never been stopped and I've driven past law enforcement, that reinforces the behavior. So doing additional enforcement, I think, is beneficial. As far as continuing to increase speed limits, we know that relative risk of fatality increases significantly as we increase the speed. We've got issues of a vehicle travel 1.1 feet per mile per hour. So a vehicle that's traveling 70 miles per hour is going to travel 77 feet per second. So it's moving pretty quickly. And we know that there's an issue with reaction time. The average human, it takes them 3/4 of a second to react to a stimulus. So as you're driving and the person brakes in front of you, for you to choose to make the decision to brake, it's at least 3/4 of a second on average for you to recognize that something has changed in your sphere and then to make the movement to change. So in 3/4 of a second, you've traveled a significant distance. And if we continue to increase those speeds, we're increasing the amount of distance a vehicle is traveling in that time. So if there's dangerous behavior going on and you don't have the time and the opportunity to change what you're doing, that creates a problem.
That math doesn't work in your favor. Let's go to Diane in Greenfield. Diane, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm having issues with when I'm either biking or walking across the pedestrian crossings. I was told by a police officer that vehicles are supposed to stop, but for the most part, none of them do. And in the area that I do want to cross, I've been noticing that let's say I'm a driver, because I also drive past that area, I'm noticing that the cars behind me are not slowing down, and I'm afraid I'm going to be rear-ended. I'm also noticing it's a two-lane road. I'm noticing the people, let's say, on my right or my left are not slowing down, so even if I stop the cars, you know, they're going to hit the biker or the walker. And another thing I've just thought about while I was waiting is at the walk signs, the same thing is happening when the walk signs, turn on for the pedestrian.
Yes.
If there's a car that wants to turn right or left, they do it. And so you're kind of at the mercy of just having to watch.
Diane, thank you for that. Chief McFarland, help us out with these pedestrian-first areas.
Sure. So state law does require drivers to yield to a pedestrian who has come to a crosswalk, whether it's marked or unmarked, and they've addressed the street saying that, or they've shown intention that they're planning to cross. So vehicles are supposed to yield and can be cited. I think it is important to recognize that if somebody is in the right, so the pedestrian is right to take the crosswalk, but they're not going to win against a car if there is a collision. So the pedestrian may need to make the choice to not cross and kind of deal with that situation, but they do have, the driver needs to yield right away to pedestrian. As far as bicyclists, if a bicyclist is going to use the crosswalk, under state law, they need to do that in a manner consistent with that of a pedestrian. So popping into a crosswalk at 20 miles an hour doesn't give vehicle traffic enough time to slow down. But if the biker addresses the crosswalk the same way that a pedestrian does and then moves through the crosswalk similar to a pedestrian, they have the same rights as a pedestrian in that particular space.
Diane, thank you for the call. We also got an email from Sarah and said, you know, look, they drive in both Milwaukee and rural areas, and Sarah experiences reckless driving in both areas and says this is definitely not an issue that is exclusive to our large cities in Wisconsin. What would you say there? Because, you know, there are studies that have found most car accident fatalities happen on rural roads. Where, you know, is this a universal issue?
I do think that it is. It's not just an urban issue, a suburban issue. Most county roads, most rural roads, speed limits have a tendency to be higher, and there's usually less vehicle traffic, which there could be a potential for drivers to kind of be paying less attention because there's not as much stuff vying for their attention in that particular space. The roadways that are out in rural areas are also typically narrower, don't have as wide of a shoulder or an opportunity for a driver to have a error that can be fixed while they're traveling down the road. So I do think it is important across the state on every highway to make sure that we're driving in a respectful manner, in a safe manner, watching out for not only us but other drivers on the road.
Chief Chapin, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me this morning. This was fun.
Aaron Chapin is McFarland Chief of Police and a police instructor at Madison College. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.